subject of marriage.
Hello, Hank.
Hello. There's a lot that everybody should know about marriage, and very often we don't. Because when two people decide to get married, we kind of get into the emotional state, and it's mostly positive emotions, and we march towards a place, a religious place or a magistrate's court, where someone who is licensed is going to talk us through the ceremony, where we're going to end up saying, I do. That little statement, I do, means we enter into a lifelong contract. In fact, the contract lasts beyond life, even after death or divorce. The terms of the contract are in place, and the crazy thing is, we've never read it. Most of us don't have the opportunity to read it, because it's all the terms are all contained in a whole set of laws, which Advocate Debbie Ainslie is going to talk us through. Now, just before I pass on to Debbie, I want to say Debbie is not a stuck-up lawyer. She is an advocate of 20 years of experience, and she's happy to be called Debbie. And in court, you will address her as advocate or counsel, but in this conversation, she's just going to be Debbie.
Good.
So, Debbie, just so people get to know you, a little bit, I'm going to ask you two questions.
Okay.
What's the worst job you've ever done?
Are you going to give me the second question first now, and then I could answer both, or are you going to do them one at a time?
No, we're going to do, all right, the second question will be, how long have you been an advocate, or how long have you practiced law?
Okay, I'm going to tackle that one first, because you said just now 20 years, and in fact, I'm in my 10th year of practice as an advocate, because I started a little late. I started studying law, I turned 45 in my first year of law, and I did a lot of different jobs before that. So to answer your first, I think my least favorite job was cleaning toilets. I was a supervisor for a cleaning company. It was called Escor van der Bijl. Furnaces which put out a black suit, and toilets are white, and the staff weren't cleaning them very well. So I spent a day cleaning a toilet to show them how it could be done.
Oh, wow.
It was interesting, but not very favorable.
Well, for me, the important takeaway on that is that there is really a path for anyone with a menial job to something much, much better. And I think one day we should do a podcast on how to make that possible.
Yes, and I'm not the forerunner in that. Lex Mpati, who was the president of the Supreme Court of Appeals, I feel like I'm following in his footsteps, because I got educated in Grahamstown, and that's where he was. And he met the advocate I had worked for as a secretary when he was a student, drinking in the bar every day. And Lex Mpati thought that if this fellow could be drunk every day and get a law degree, so could he. So he went from bartendering to petrol attendant so that he could go to school, to go to varsity during the day and study at night when there weren't that many people at the getting petrol. And he became the president of the Supreme Court of Appeals, an absolutely amazing, bright, wonderful man.
What a wonderful story. What a wonderful story. And it's certainly a good example for all of us.
Yeah. It's always hope.
Okay. So let's jump into the subject of marriage.
Hold on, Hank. Before we do that, the listeners don't know who you are, do they?
Oh, okay. No, they don't.
Okay, I've given the game away that I'm an old bully, because since I've been practicing for 10 years and I only started studying in my turn 45. So tell me about you quickly.
All right, very briefly. I'm old, so it's a long story, so I'm going to try and cut it down to very little. But I did study law a little bit. I got half of a LLB degree. So But that was 50 years ago. So, and the laws have obviously changed in that time, and certainly even the country has changed. So my knowledge of law is totally outdated. I spent most of my career and working for IBM, doing all sorts of things from programming to managing to eventually retiring before I built a wine farm. And as Debbie once said to me, she thought I was smart because buying a wine farm is a dumb thing to do. And so that's my story. I have know a little bit, but not nearly enough about the law.
Okay.
One last thing. I am also mostly blind. So whatever I do, if I sometimes hesitate, it's because my screen reader is a bit slow in guiding me to remember to say the right thing or to read the right thing. Okay.
Thanks, Hank.
Okay, so let's jump into the subject of marriage. First of all, South African law recognizes different kinds of marriages, doesn't it?
Yes, yeah. We have a number of different legislation around it. The one that generally people know is the Marriage Act, which is a normal civil marriage. And within that, you can be married in community of property or out of community of property with or without accrual. And I'll explain those details just now. But we also have, you can get married under Hindu rites and have that marriage registered. And that will then fall under the Marriages Act. Muslim marriages are a whole different kettle of fish. And there's been a lot of legislation around it. And there have been some Muslim marriages that are registered under the Marriage Act as it is, but it is going to be leading to very shortly an entire new legislative framework for marriages. We also have the civil union, which is in every way the same as a civil marriage, except that in a civil union, your spouses can be of the same sex. Don't have to. Many heterosexuals choose to marry under the civil union as a just acknowledgement of not wanting gay marriages to be different. And then the big one, which applies to so many of or such a large proportion of our population, is the recognition of Customary Marriages Act. And that has to do with all customary marriages. It recognizes the customs and traditions and recognizes those marriages as equal to civil marriages or whatever, or your civil unions, and in the eyes of the law. It becomes complicated because there's so many differences between, and I will use the word in legislation, the different tribes. So, and then also because it follows customs and traditions, which forever change, to acknowledge whether that marriage is actually a valid marriage or not, one has to look at that particular community and look at what their traditions are and how that formulates into a marriage.
Oh, but wow.
But everybody gets divorced through the divorce courts.
Okay. Wow. That really makes it complicated. There's a lot for you to know, but for each of us, there's only one thing to know, because I'm either a traditional marriage guy or a Muslim or a Christian or a Jew or whatever. So I'm only one thing.
Yes.
But I can also be gay or heterosexual. Any one of us is mostly just one thing.
Yes. One or two. The Marriages Act comes into it. And then also, those are just the things about the procedures of getting married. That's not necessarily what controls the financial, your estate aspect and that. There's more legislation that controls that. So yeah. What I think right at say, for example, the Marriages Act, you were saying about rushing off to a magistrate's office or a church to get married. But the Marriages Act actually will provide what words have to be said before you say the I do and the I kiss the bride, which is the part actually that they look forward to, Hank.
Okay.
And that it's got to be witnessed is important as well. So that all is covered in the Marriage Act, and in these various acts. Okay, so how do you recognize that a wedding has taken place? It's got to be there's a formula for it. And if you're going to your local dominie, his church has submitted exactly what words he's going to say, and that's been approved by government. It's called solemnizing a wedding, a marriage, and it has to be done in a certain way.
Mm. Okay, I just have one question, which we're now talking about kind of formal marriages of some kind, where there's a ceremony and a contract being entered into. What about people that live together? Let's say they decide to live together and they end up sharing everything, sharing assets, sharing expenses, and they do that for 10, 20 years. Do they accidentally enter into some kind of marriage contract?
I love the accidentally. Yes and no. Real lawyer's answer. Sorry about that, but it depends. So we do not have a concept which is in the American law, which is in the movies, as about a common law husband or wife. That does not exist. We also don't, at this point, have a recognized way of entering into a contract with the other person that's applicable against third parties. So remember that your marriage is a contract between you and your spouse, but it's also as a change of status law, and it's enforceable against third parties. So if you are, example, married out of community or property, you own the one spouse owns theirs and the other spouse owns their own property, a creditor can't come looking to the other spouse. Community or property, both spouses, the creditors can come after the entirety of the estate. So we get things like domestic partnership agreements. Any two parties can enter into an agreement. So if you start living together, you can enter into an agreement between yourselves, and it can be binding between the two of you, but it's not binding against the outside world. So in that way, you can't accidentally fall into an agreement between the two of you. But as you correctly said, marriage lasts after the death, because it sets up what's going to happen after death. But basically, this marriage dissolves in two ways, either divorce or death. And what you choose on the before you get married, how you choose to be married, is going to decide on the dissolution of the marriage. So either on death or on divorce, what's going to happen. So that's what you're setting up when you get married, is when you die. So people say, oh, I don't want to think about that because I'm never going to get divorced, even though the divorce statistics are so high. You must remember also that marriage ends with the divorce, and how your money is treated when you die depends on what you chose before you got married. So going back to that answer, we also have what we call a universal partnership, which is normally a business arrangement. And one of the things is to make a profit. And we often use that when there's been a very long partnership between two people who've been living together as if they are spouses, as if they're married. We will use that to be able to claim. More often than not, it's in death. Also, that there's an act called Maintenance of Surviving Spouse Act. And it was always strictly only if you were married. So it was like, if you did not get married, you chose not to continue supporting that person that you supported maybe for 30 years. But after you died, you just chose not to, because you chose not to marry them. Then came the fact that gay people could not marry previously. So in interpreting that act, they said that because they could not marry, if they were living together, that was, and supporting each other, there had to be proof of financially supporting, taking on that burden, that duty to support. For gay couples, that was allowed. Then when the civil union came in, where gays were allowed to get married, That persisted. And then, so quite recently, I think this year or end of last year, a matter went all the way to the Constitutional Court that said, if you chose the duty to support when you're alive, it doesn't matter whether you were in a heterosexual or a homosexual relationship. It is it, the definition of spouse in that act now includes a person that you were living with in a romantic relationship that you supported or who you supported. And as long as there's proof of your intention to support that person and you did support them, you then qualify as a spouse, inverted commas, in terms of that act.
Okay. So in those circumstances, if they should separate, the one can have a claim against the other for continued support of some sort.
No, only if you die.
Only if you die.
If you separate, you separate. So that's your safety blanket. Don't live with the person.
Okay. My next question was going to be, what should you know before you get married? But I think you're answering that as we're going along. But
there's a most important thing that you need to know is that if you intend to be married without joining your estates. So if you get married in community of property, everything that is mine, everything that is his becomes ours on the day you get married. And if you don't stipulate that before the date of marriage by doing an antenuptial contract, then you can. It's an enormous expense to change that, even if the court allows it to be changed, if both parties still agree to it. So you can't wait until you're married to decide that. You can't wait to the day of your wedding to decide that. You have to be aware of all of these options, all the consequences, at least 3 months before you get married, so that you can choose it and go and do the options. And choose the option that's best for you as a future spouses.
Well, I didn't know you could even change anything after you got married, but you say they are, with difficulty you can.
Yes.
Okay. Now, yeah.
Do you want me to elaborate on that now, or do it later? We'll go into that later.
I think that's going to be a big subject, so I'm going to skip over it. Is that okay with you?
Absolutely.
Okay, because the question I want to ask is, what? Obviously, you mentioned the antenuptial contract. Now, two things about the antenuptial contract is, one question, first of all, is obviously an emotional thing. It is one party will want to protect his or her assets. And the other party will say, hey, you don't really love me that much if you want to do this. So it's contentious. Is that correct?
It can be, but I disagree with that assumption entirely, and I'll tell you why. Everyone presumes that I'm going to just refer to it as an ANC rather than an antenuptial contract, just because it's quicker. And I know no political connotations to that whatsoever. Okay, so people think of, if you're going to enter into an ANC, you are making provision for when you get divorced, and that is not true, because although it does make provision for in case of a divorce, but what it does is it's also taking care of if you die. It's also protecting the other spouse's assets from creditors. So one of the really useful times that is that you would want to use an ANC is if one of the spouses has got their own business, because that protects the other spouse from their creditors. So if one of the two parties, or even both parties, want to start their own business, you want to protect the other person's estate from being able to be claimed from creditors or to become insolvent. So if you are marrying somebody who has their own business, who has some risk from outside people, an ANC is actually protecting the spouse so that their assets can't be claimed. from outside creditors. So that perception that an ANC is I'm keeping everything to myself is not necessarily what is happening. And I would say in most instances where parties are entering into an ANC. The other thing that if one party has a large number of assets, especially marriages with later in life where what you own, you don't want to just join in with another person. You want to retain what is owned, because if I own a 10 million rand house down the coast and I marry somebody who's got a 5 million rand house up the coast, but he's got a business and his creditors now come for 15 million rand, they can take my 10 million rand house because the day, and they can do that the day after we get married because it becomes ours. So yeah. An ANC can say, I'm keeping my 10, you keeping your 5. We're keeping it outside of the marriage because we each own our own thing. His creditors can only get his 5 million rand house. They cannot touch my 10 million. And then we do the accrual and we say, look, we're a partnership. We're keeping our own assets, but we're going to see who earns, whose estate increases the most. So our starting values are 10 and 5. And if at the end I have now got, I've lost 5 million and so I haven't accrued anything, but he's, because I've been supporting him and I've been being a brilliant wife and created all the avenues for him to flourish in his business or I've, whatever it is, and he's now worth 20 million. His difference is 15 and we split that. I get half of that growth in his estate automatically because of accrual, if you choose accrual in your ANC.
Okay, so that can be done. That makes a lot of sense. Now, from my ancient legal studies, I remember that there's a law that limits or controls gifts between husband and wife. Does that still exist?
It only limits those gifts in terms of the tax implication. Now we're going into the Income Tax Act. You can gift to a spouse, you can gift to a trust, and depending on who you're gifting to and charities, you know, non-profit organizations and things, and then depending on the amount is when you get taxed. But I can gift my husband my 10 million rand house. I've got to watch out for capital gains tax. I've got to watch out for gifting tax. But there's no restriction on the actual gift. It's just what the tax man wants out of his portion of it.
All right, because if you're now approaching insolvency, so you can gift your 10 million rand house. No. You can't do that.
If I gift my 10 million rand house within 2 years of insolvency, the trustees of the insolvent estate can claim it back.
Okay.
Because it's a gift without value, and it's just a dissipating of your assets. It's just trying to protect your assets. So no, within, if you've done a major gift within 2 years before an insolvency, the trustees can claim it back. And even if it's a gift for lesser value, they can claim it back. So if it's not market value. Okay. I can't even sell it to him for 5 when it's worth 10.
Mm. Yeah. All right. So what I hear from that is it is absolutely a wise thing to sign an ANC before you get married. Because we don't think that far ahead mostly, but most marriages do end in divorce and death. And you want to control some of what happens to assets, and you want to protect some of your assets. Is that correct?
If you're in business and you've got this potential third party risk, if ever one of the people are in business, and that is one of the things that the court will allow you to change your matrimonial property regime from in community, for example, to out of community, is if you are now starting a business, then you divide that in community of property at that time. You make an application to the court. You've got to advertise as if it's a deceased estate or whatever. You've got to put adverts in the paper, you've got to acknowledge creditors out of the joint estate, and then you can then separate those estates out. But it's about remember the difference is the contract between the two parties is enforceable against the rest of the world, and your status is obviously affected by a marriage. So. For example, if you are married in community of property and you want to purchase a house, you have to have your spouse's permission to do so. You can't just do that if you are married in community of property. Your status is affected as well in that way. Thank goodness we no longer have matrimonial power sitting with men, vested with men. That doesn't exist anymore. That was the biggest thing about status was the woman became an equivalent of a child again. Had no say. Men had the matrimony. They had marital power, but that no longer exists. There's now equal power, but you still have to speak to each other. You have to. Bank can't open a bank account for a man married in community of property without his wife's permission. Overdraft and vice versa.
That's all about property, etc. And now, when you get married, the you have a duty of support, right? And it goes two ways. Both parties have a duty of supporting the other, correct?
Correct, yes.
And that means that's what we mean by in sickness and in health and all that. Now,
yes.
What other duties that are not really obvious would there be between husband and wife?
One of the duties that no longer exists is the duty to you no longer have to bed your husband or your wife.
Okay.
There used to be a thing that you had to service your spouse. You don't have to anymore. And the grounds for divorce in the past, your conjugal rights were not being met. It was grounds for divorce. It's no longer a right. You no longer have that right. And also a husband can no longer, it used to be the husband can't rape his wife. It was not a possibility because he was entitled to have sex with her whenever he wanted, in whatever way he wanted. That obviously doesn't exist anymore either. We also have a no-fault divorce, which has changed over the years. I think it was, can't remember what year, 1979. There's no fault. You don't have to prove a party was at fault. You just have to prove that the marriage is broken down for a divorce. Previously, there had to be blame placed somewhere. Mm.
Okay, now, it just makes me think of Middle Eastern religions, Muslim religions specifically. The duty of
the duty of support.
And the duty of sex. Does it apply to Muslims as well? That law?
It will apply. Yeah. There's a lot of conflict in the Muslim marriages, and there's been litigation around that, and there's a very long and detailed series of judgments actually around that. But the issue with Muslim marriages, firstly, is retaining of the marital power, our constitution can't support because of the equality, section 9, you know, equal. You can't recognize a woman being a minor, basically, legally speaking, and back to child state-like state in a marriage that based on the fact that she's A, married, and B, a woman. So that's problem number one. Problem number two, luck is just, you know, you just, I divorce you, and your duty to support in a Muslim marriage is basically 1 month, one menstrual cycle. And the only reason and that it is that, and that, and the woman must stay indoors and not have any male visitors, is to make sure that she's not pregnant. The other thing is that the children, inverted commas, belong to the husband, the father, once they're divorced by a talak. So none of those things are in line with our constitution. Also, people say that the Muslim marriages being polygamous is also not constitutional, but we do have that in recognition of customary marriages. We can have, a man can have more than one wife, but it is now regulated in terms of permissions and the joint estate, because a customary marriage is now a marriage in community of property. It headbutts against a tradition, the role of the man and the family, and the man is the custodian and not the owner of property, but we're busy working through those little difficulties, massive difficulties actually. But so there's other things related to how Muslim marriages regulate under religious law, which hasn't been compatible with South Africa, and that's where the headache has come in. And hopefully, the new marriages bill that is going to come that will hopefully. It's overdue, and the Constitution had given 2 years to get that out, but it's out for commentary and things, so we're not there yet.
Okay. Let's talk about children.
Yes.
They are jointly owned, or owned, the wrong word, but we can't own children, do we? What would be the correct word?
So the Children's Act changed all the terminology around children, and it's really children-focused. So we talk about parents being co-holders of responsibilities and rights for children. And it divides it into a bundle of things like the duty to take care, contact being the old access when you can see a child and have a child stay with you, whatever, maintenance of a child, and then guardianship. And then guardianship is again divided into a bundle of rights. So if you've got guardianship, you are the person who says the child is allowed to get married before they become adult, or allowed to travel overseas, allowed to be adopted. And that guardianship. And what's also interesting is that it's not just only parents who can be co-holders of parental rights and responsibilities, but interested parties. So now you have a family and your spouse dies, their parent, so the children's grandparent, can actually get some rights. And it might be the right to have the children every once a month or every second weekend or something, just so that relationship carries on. A person can get that. The other major change in the Children's Act that didn't exist before is unmarried children born to unmarried parents. Firstly, they're no longer bastards. They are children born to unmarried parents, and a father automatically has rights. Like, we call it Section 21 rights because that's a section that deals with unmarried fathers. But as long as they have taken an interest in the child, contributed to maintenance, ipso facto, they have full parental rights and responsibilities.
Okay, now in South Africa, there are lots and lots of instances of unmarried parents with a child. Mm-hmm.
Yes.
And very often the father disappears. Is that he surely has continued duties to support if he can be found or identified?
Yes. Remember, it's the child's right to be maintained and to have contact with the parent. Parents often think it's their responsibility to pay maintenance and it's their right to see their child. No, it's the child's right to be maintained and the child's right to have with parents, plural. So that child's right doesn't extinguish if the other parent didn't need maintenance and didn't pursue it, and then the child gets to 18, wants to go to varsity, and the biological father has never contributed, the child can still take that parent to court and say, okay, pay my varsity now. As long as that parent has got the means And if they are educated to a level of university education, then the child should be they should pay for the child to have the same. So there has actually been litigation where a child more than once sued a parent to pay for the university, successfully sued.
Okay. What about step parents? Now, let's say my parents are divorced and I now have a stepfather who hasn't adopted me. And I want to go to university, and he says, I'm not paying for it. Have I got any rights?
The step parent has no direct duty to support. The step parent generally is supporting their spouse, who has a duty to support. If those parents are married in community of property. So if my mom is married to my stepfather in community of property and I want to go to varsity, then it's through my mother's interest in that estate that I can claim against my stepfather to pay for my varsity. If they're not married to property and he's taken on the duty to support, and say now my mother dies now and my stepfather has supported me and my mother for whatever, I can make out a case that he accepted a duty to support me, I have got prospects of success. Not brilliant, but if he's taken on the duty to support, then, and it's not just through my mother being, that he's supporting my mother to support me, there could be a case to be made out for that. There has been mixed success in the courts. There have been cases like that. Some have won and some have not. And it depends. It's fact-specific.
Okay. We've touched on divorce, but we haven't really gone into detail. First of all, if you have an ANC or if you don't have an ANC, now a couple of questions around divorce. Grounds for divorce can be just the marriage is broken down, or we just both agree, correct?
Correct. We both agree that the marriage is broken down. You cannot get a divorce unless your marriage is broken down. So you can't get a divorce because you want to change your matrimonial property regime, for example. You've got to say under oath that your marriage is broken down. Proof of a marriage being broken down is you've lived apart for a year and not had any nookie for a year. You haven't been intimate with your spouse for a year. We call it in court, we haven't lived together as man and wife. So even though you're living under the same roof, if you haven't actually been intimate for a year, that is often sufficient. But living apart for a year is sufficient proof that the marriage is broken down. And you do have to say that the marriage is broken down. You can't just say we want a divorce because we don't want to wear our wedding rings anymore, So that we and people do why I'm emphasizing this and is because one of the times that you can get your pension is if you get divorced, because it used to be that if you married in community of property or through accrual, you could be entitled, because pension forms part of the estate, so you could be entitled to a portion of your spouse's pension as part of the whole estate. So it could be as much as 50% of that pension. And then it used to wait until you were of pensionable, when you retired, that you were able to access that pension. But in the meantime, it hadn't grown at all. So now you can access that pension immediately so that you can invest it for your own retirement. But people are now getting divorced so that they can actually access their pensions to get out of the debt that they're in, or to be able to make a purchase or whatever. And that is fraud. So if your marriage is not broken down and you say, yeah, I'm getting divorced, I just want to get divorced, and you're trying to access the pension, that is a criminal offense.
Oh, okay. So you can go, all right. And you can go to jail.
Yeah.
Two things in divorce, clearly assets, continued support, and children. What And I want to ask about children in two categories, children that are very young and children who are in their teens. Do they have a say in what happens to them?
Yes. Okay, so when a child is 10 years old or is younger than that but has the intelligence and the maturity, their voices must be heard. Now, that is normally done through a process of going to the Office of the Family Advocate, which is a government institution that any divorce that involves a child in South Africa, the family advocate has to be involved. They get the divorce papers. If they see any red flags, they'll hold an inquiry and they'll make a recommendation to the court. The process of holding an inquiry is done with a social worker and a qualified advocate, who parents and the children. And the children get to say what they want and where they want to be. That does not equate to them getting what they want. The best interests of the child is, it's an institution, it's in our Children's Act. If a child is best served with going with one parent and not with the other, despite their wishes, then that will be the recommendation. But generally, the rule of thumb is children need to be in contact with both their parents. And if one of the parents is a danger to the child, we try and put up guardrails. We try and do protections so that they still maintain contact but are protected throughout that contract. So say now contact. Say now, for example, one of the parents is an alcoholic. That we might introduce something like breathalyzer tests or supervised contact or something that will protect the child while allowing the child's right to have contact with their parent to continue. But if the child says, I want to go and live with that alcoholic parent because I can, you know, get toys, I don't have a bedtime and I don't need to do my homework, then obviously the child's wish might be that and they can voice it, but the grown-ups and particularly the High Court as upper guardian of every single child in the country will decide what is the best interests of the child. So the child has a say, but it's not a final say.
Now, in the old days, the mother typically had bigger control about getting custody of the children. Is that still the case?
I think that we still have a little bit of a bias towards mothers because of society. But the starting point is shared, equal contact, responsibility. The default is that it should be shared. Unfortunately, logistically, that is actually sometimes very, very difficult. And what we're looking for is the primary carer. So who is the child's primary carer will get the primary residence often. But so you don't want, the child to go and live with dad who's works away from home 6 weeks of
yeah, whatever.
Every three or pair. But I do more and more. I do one week, where a child lives with mom for 1 week and dad for 1 week. And they often will, idea of co-parenting post-divorce is extremely difficult, but it is amazing how many human beings are wonderful enough to actually achieve it. And mom has 1 week, dad has 1 week, they have half holidays. They sometimes, I've even on a couple of occasions had families who do like Christmas together. Oh, it doesn't happen often enough because obviously the problem ones come to me, not the easy ones.
divorce is all hard and emotional, isn't it?
Yeah, but sometimes staying together is worse. We have so much more protections now for children and for women. It used to be that if there was domestic violence, the police would say it's a private matter. It no longer is. We have courts where people can go unrepresented to get protection orders, and they get a warrant of arrest at the when that order is broken. The person doesn't obey that order. And it can be done on an urgent basis, and they can get in there urgently. Obviously, it is also open to abuse, but it does mean that that there are some ways of getting out of relationships where 50 years ago that wasn't possible. It still has all the psychological problems, you know, a battered spouse. And it's not only women who are battered spouses, I might add, but a battered spouse has all the psychological chains that bind, and not just – so the law is trying to make it easier for her to protect herself and her children, but often the psychology prevents that, and we don't have enough resources in that regard yet in the country as far as I'm concerned.
Wow. Listen, this is a book full of information, and and we've been going for quite a while now, and I want us to limit the time so that this doesn't get boring. So I'm going to ask that we summarize and say, understand what you enter into, understand the importance of an antenuptial contract, an ANC, and understand and also anticipate that nearly 50% of people do get divorced.
It's so more than 50%.
Is that so? So understand the rights and duties right from the outset. Understand that an ANC helps you protect both parties' properties and you protects you against creditors. And I think we've covered what happens to your assets and children when you get divorced. I have just one final question. An ANC requires a lawyer, correct?
Correct.
You can't download a sample ANC contract from the internet and change it and say, here's my ANC contract.
No, you can download it, but you still have to take it to a lawyer, a specific type of lawyer, a notary, and it has to be, it gets lodged in the deeds office. So the same place where it keeps records of all trusts and all, of all property and all of that, that is actually registered there. So anywhere in South Africa, you can access that record and say, okay, this person's got an ANC. And that requires that. It's not a hellish expensive thing. The difficulty is to work out what to include, what to exclude, what your starting values are, and that needs to be taken seriously. But then it gets registered, and that's why you have to go to a notary, notes it, and then registers it for you. And then it's applicable against, remember, because you want it to be enforceable against the entire world, all the creditors and everything. So they must have a means of finding out what your marital status is. And that's why it's registered at the deeds office.
Okay.
And that must be done within a, you got to complete it before you get married, and then it's got to be lodged. I think it's within 3 months. It might be 6 weeks, but the notary will know that when it's got to be lodged by and registered by immediately after the marriage.
Okay. So I'm out of questions for the subject. So what have I missed? Is there anything you want to add as a summary?
There's one thing I just want to add is that under customary law, people presume that they get married by customary law and it's the equivalent of a religious ceremony without legal consequence, and that then they can go and do the white wedding later, which is a civil marriage. What in fact it is the traditional wedding is a in community or property marriage that is valid and enforceable against everybody. And if you want to do an ANC, you ought to have done it before the customary marriage. So many people I know have got small businesses, little plumbers, little painters, whatever, and they're getting married in community or property, and they in their traditional wedding, thinking that they'll sort it out later, and they can't.
Okay.
Other than that, that's it.
Debbie, that was a book full, more than a mouthful. Thank you so much for all this information. I think we're going to probably have to have another session sometime about more detailed questions. I'm going to invite the audience to post their questions in the chat box below, and we'll answer them as they come in.
Thank you.
Okay. And Debbie, it was wonderful talking to you.
Until next time, then.
Until next time, have a good day.